Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy of the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of The Spiritual Life by St. Theophane the Recluse. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back, everybody, to our study of St. Theophane's correspondence with the young Anastasia. And we're moving right along. We're picking up this evening with letter 61, entitled Guarding the Hearing and the Sight. And we've talked many times before about the fact that we are in a constant state of receptivity, that through all of our senses throughout the course of the day, we're constantly filtering things that come into our mind or that we hear or that we see and or that we touch. And so in the spiritual life, we find in the Fathers an emphasis on what an impact that has upon us, that throughout the course of the day, we are confronted with so many different things that our minds and hearts have to process. And certainly on a spiritual level, we have to see how they affect us in relation to whether or not they stimulate the passions or they give rise to the feelings, thoughts, and desires that give rise to the passions. And so tonight, he's focusing with her on hearing and sight in particular. And we're picking up on page 247. And he had been making a number of points with her. And we're on the fourth point about a third of the way down the page, if you're following in the text. He begins by saying, I already wrote you about reinterpreting everything you encounter and that you might encounter in the spiritual sense. It is necessary to do this also with respect to objects of evil significance. After encountering them, you will not have bad thoughts, but good ones instead. In the same way, when St. Ephrem the Syrian, having encountered an enticingly dressed woman, told his disciples, you see how she takes care to adorn her body, which will soon be dust. How can we not be concerned with adorning our immortal soul? So this should sound somewhat familiar to you, that in the beginning, not in the beginning, about the middle of the way through the text, he began talking with her about St. Ticon's writing on reinterpreting things from our day-to-day life that we would encounter and reinterpreting them in such a way that they draw the mind and the heart to God. And so they don't have to necessarily be something that's sinful. It can actually be benign, but nonetheless, it's things that we would see and encounter throughout the day, but we would use them in such a way as a means to drawing the mind and the heart to God. So we would reinterpret them, in other words, in a spiritual fashion. And we did come across St. Ticon's book, and I could post that along with this podcast and the link to it. But we'd even thought about as a group, maybe engaging a little project doing that in sort of a modernized sense as a spiritual tool. That how is it that we would have these short little reflections that we could make use of throughout the course of the day to gently turn the mind and the heart to God. And here he comes back to that, telling her that I've already shown you how to do this, but now he's showing her how to do it in particular when she's confronted or might be confronted with something that would be overtly sinful. And he makes use of St. Ephrem the Syrian, who was one of the great Syriac writers right around. He preceded St. Isaac the Syrian, who we just finished reading not too long ago. Beautiful writer. If you ever have a chance in particular to read his Spiritual Psalter, it's a book of 150 meditations that have as their main focus repentance. And so it's particularly good during the holy season of Lent. But I've gone through it. I've gone back to it over and over again, almost on a daily basis. So if you're looking for a little meditation on a daily basis, St. Ephrem's work is very good. But he's making reference to him here now in regards to this practice of reinterpreting something. And so they, I think we would be probably doing this all day long with the one example that he gives her, but a woman dressed enticingly. And so he reinterprets it for his disciples, you know, to think about our own mortality, that eventually we are all reduced to dust. So sort of what we do on Ash Wednesday is what Ephrem is encouraging his disciples to do, that not to become overly focused upon the externals, not to judge any person, but rather to reinterpret what one is seeing and to do it in such a way that it helps draw the mind and the heart to something that would be beneficial spiritually. In this case, one's own mortality, that you know, even though something is so beautifully adorned, and perhaps she herself was beautiful, that one might not become overly focused upon that in the sense of objectifying her or how she's dressed, but rather reinterpreting in such a way that it makes us remember death, memento mori, and one of the practices of the fathers, remember death. Okay, so do you remember that from earlier on in the text, St. Tikhon? Okay, good. These rules are sufficient, he goes on to tell her. It would be proper to indicate those contingencies in your everyday life that are harmful to your inner life. But I suppose that there are none, either in your immediate family or relatives. You would not come across them in any way except outside the home, for example, in the society in which you spend little time, as you wrote, with regard to such contingencies, keep to what was written in the third point. Then place all similar things you encounter in the future under this rule. Make it a general rule to measure what is permissible by the influence that it exerts inwardly. You may permit yourself that which is constructive. Do not permit that which disturbs in any form. Who in his right mind would knowingly drink from a glass into which poison had been poured? So at home, he realizes that she's not typically going to have to do this with those that she knows. But as she ventures out into the world, if you remember, she had moved to Moscow. And so she had moved to the city, and she had already come under the influence of those who were more progressively minded in their day. And so he engages her very early on about this. And so it's knowing that she's going to have to venture out into the world to work and to live, that she's going to have a means to engage in this little spiritual practice, that there are some things that she will encounter, he tells her, that will be constructive and that won't be a danger to her at all spiritually, and that she'll have to be discriminating then in terms of how she views things. But inevitably, she will come across things where she will have to engage in this spiritual practice in order to help the mind and the imagination to fix on something else that would be more constructive. And, you know, this should make sense to us, but we often do, I think, what Theophan says, that we will drink out of a glass that's filled with poison, even knowing that it's something that's not spiritually healthy for us. And so as a young woman, I think he wants to help her form those patterns of thought in such a way that she can distinguish the things that are going to be constructive or destructive for her, and then immediately engage in this spiritual practice. So to the point that she wouldn't even have to think about it. I think when we first read this, it sounds, oh man, that would be very difficult throughout the course of the day to sort of pull apart everything that we would encounter and interpret it spiritually. But I think once a person gets into this habit of mind, it should be something that's very fluid for us. And that would be true also of the practice of the short prayers that he's taught her, in particular the Jesus prayer. that it can become such a habit of mind that our practice of it becomes as fluid as so many of the other things that we do naturally throughout the course of a day. It's just that it's harder after maybe years of neglect or just not being taught about it to establish a habit very quickly. Okay. So far, are you following him along in terms of what he's trying to help her do here? Okay. I do not have in mind that you restrict yourself and become a recluse. I just want to guide you toward the decision to not take in what is harmful for your spirit. Since you determined that the only true life is that in the spirit and have also experienced this, may the Lord bless you. So if you remember going back to the very beginning, what she asked him in writing him and asking for spiritual direction is to help her and teach her the path where she can embrace the full dignity as a Christian woman. And so how does she engage in the world in such a way that she doesn't lose hold of what is most important to her and what is most fundamental in regards to that identity? Okay. Any thoughts about letter 61 at all? Okay, letter 62, active warfare with the passions. Just a little bit of a call it a digression here from what he's been talking with her about so far in these last letters. He makes a distinction here for her now between active spiritual warfare active warfare and spiritual warfare. So what goes on in our mind? So what he's been instructing her up to do up to this point. And so he had just been teaching her that if you come across something, you reinterpret it spiritually within the mind, or you engage in, you know, the Jesus prayer or other such things. And but here he makes this distinction about the specific practices that we might engage in that also help us in the spiritual battle. So he moves from simply, say, dealing with the thoughts, the feelings, and the desires, the things that would go on a more internal level, to the external behaviors and actions that she's going to find helpful in the spiritual battle. And this is important for us in our day as well. I mean, I think sometimes when we think about our spiritual disciplines, we also pick and choose certain things and often pick and choose the things that we like the most, but maybe neglect perhaps some of the important things to deal with certain passions. Okay. May the grace of God be with you. With regard to guidance for the cleansing of the passions, what has been said is sufficient because they are within you to such a small degree. As we've already begun talking about it, however, I will add a little more, which you may find useful right now, not at some point in the future. So he realizes again that Anastasia, you know, came from a very good family, is deeply rooted in the faith, and she has these sensibilities that she prizes and holds precious, the spiritual life. And she's already fostered this kind of watchfulness of heart and these sensibilities that hold precious the things that God has given to her. But nonetheless, he wants to provide her with some things that would help her presently to already strengthen her position, as it were, to strengthen some of the virtues that she already has developed over time. The warfare prescribed with the passions is spiritual. It is real because by not permitting the passions to feed on something, it exhausts them. But there's also active warfare with the passions that consist in the deliberate undertaking and carrying out of actions that are directly opposed to those passions. So he tells her that, you know, the main battle for us is with the thoughts, because it's, as we mentioned, we have sometimes tens of thousands of thoughts throughout the day. And it is these thoughts, even if they are activated by certain external stimuli, It's these thoughts that then give rise to certain feelings, that then give rise to certain desires to satisfy the passions. But there is this other kind of act of warfare that he's not now going to expose her to, even though she's engaged in a very disciplined way in the internal warfare. For example, to suppress stinginess, it is necessary to become generous. To combat pride, it is necessary to choose humbling occupations. To combat carousing, one must stay at home, and the like. It is true that one such mode of action does not lead directly to the goal, because the passion enduring external constraint may erupt inward, either that same passion or some other in its place. When inner and spiritual warfare are united with this active combat, however, they soon defeat any passion against which they are directed together. So, you know, the primary battle is internal. It's with the thoughts. But when you do add the ascetical life and this external battle of engaging in these certain behaviors, like staying at home if you have this temptation to carousing, or if you're filled with pride that you would choose a humbling occupation, you know, whether it would be in the home or in your work in general. So something that sort of doesn't feed the ego. And so when you combine this with the taking hold of one's thoughts and one's feelings, you can completely tamp down the passions and the things that lead to them. That internal battle, he tells her, is really sufficient. That you can get to a point that you have this watchfulness of heart, and that you are praying so deeply that the things that would trigger the feelings and the desires that lead to the passions really find no entry. And so if you're disciplined with this internal warfare, you've progressed pretty far in the spiritual life, but also you're likely victorious a great deal of the time in the warfare itself. But if you add these external things, you really strengthen yourself on another level. And I think in our day in particular, not that Anastasia's was perhaps any less difficult than our own, I think we have so many things in our world that can be a source of temptation for us, that these external actions can be very important. And so we should probably just stay home all the time and not watch any TV or listen to any music. Everybody okay with that? Sound pretty good. It works. but we would have to be disciplined. You know, I think more than, I think people are generally given to be in our day and age. You know, certainly even seeing a PG-13 movie anymore, things have shifted so far to the point that what once was rated R is now become something PG-13. And so, discriminating in the spiritual life is actually a good thing. It's the one time when discrimination is something that's positive, that we are able to see with a kind of clarity the distinctions between things that are important here. What is going to lead us down a path that could give rise to the passions? And so when we are thinking about what we're going to do for our day or what we're going to do for entertainment, say we're going out with a group of friends and we're making plans to do that, what is it that we would choose as a group that would be entertaining but not necessarily be a source of temptation for others or give rise to the passions? And so perhaps going to, you know, a kind of dance club where there's a certain kind of dancing that's going on and a certain way of dressing wouldn't necessarily be the best place for a person to go if you're trying to foster chastity and purity of heart, knowing, you know, the kind of dancing in our day, but also the kind of dress that people wear in going out. Or even, say, going to a movie that, again, we might be a little bit more discriminating there, that there are certain, I think even the church has a certain review of movies to sort of let people know the nature of the content and what it would be, who it would be appropriate for, or the themes of the movie, so that we would make a greater effort in our lives to, again, discriminate between those things that would be fine for us spiritually or constructive, that would be good entertainment for us in terms of lightening the burden of day-to-day life, allowing us to have, you know, genuine entertainment. And then those things that would be perhaps put us in jeopardy. So it makes sense. I think it's pretty clear what he's telling us. And this is where I think in our day and age, we really have to look at it closely because we have, you know, because of our access to social media and things such as that, we often don't have a whole lot of time because of the ease with which we can have access to it, or the swiftness that it often will come up on our computer by our making use of certain forms of social media, even, or movies that, again, are rated in a certain way, that it might turn out that within them there's something for a Christian who's really trying to foster a kind of purity of heart or maintain this kind of internal stillness or state of recollection. That there might be certain themes, you know, not necessarily sensual, but it could be even violence, I think, in our day, you know, that it is so explicit and so constant, and that there it can leave the person with an agitated mind and heart coming out of it. And, you know, what I even think news programs, I'm just going to throw this in there, not to be provocative, but I think you know, news is no longer reporting the news, that there is a constant commentary on certain things, but then there's also this repetitive aspect of it. Do you remember when CNN first came on the air? Some of the people that maybe are a little bit older here, it was truly this like 24-hour programming. So there were new news stories throughout the course of the day. And now it's like every half hour is repeated. Or if you go on some of the other stations, they will talk about certain world events over and over again, and they will dramatize them as if they aren't dramatic enough. But they will have a group of people, like five people, discussing the same circumstances throughout the world. And they'll often be talking over each other in this kind of heated way. And so if you listen to these news programs too long, they can sort of agitate the mind and the heart, and they can steal from us something that we are otherwise trying to foster throughout the course of any given day, which is to maintain an internal stillness. Hezekiah, you know, is really one of the main themes within the Philokalia, stillness. That we are seeking to foster, to slow things down, our thoughts, and engage in this kind of unceasing prayer in order that we might be more attentive to God throughout the course of the day and be able to listen on a very deep level. So we're fostering a kind of silence and stillness within in such a way that we can really be attentive to the will of God in our life and how he's acting in our day-to-day life. And so if we're exposing ourselves to things that might even seem benign to us, not overtly objectionable, and maybe even seem important to us, they can agitate the mind and the heart, that they make us vulnerable. Maybe not to what is being talked about itself, but they just stir up anxiety, fear, anger in the heart when we hear them. And then before you know it, we can be in this state of rumination over these things for hours. And so even with things such as this, I think I'm sure St. Theophan would say, you know, you really have to look at how much time you are exposing yourself to this. or even where you do seek your news or how you approach it. You know, growing up, it was nothing like this. It was the daily newspaper. And so there was something almost of a calming aspect to that, that you would, you know, people would read the newspaper, you know, from cover to cover and would actually read whole stories, believe it or not, not just the first paragraph. And, but there could be something that would be calming about that, because there's this sustained silent, you know, the guys were talking tonight about when they were growing up in school, and even now some of them are teaching, of periods of sustained silent reading, SSR, they were calling it, and that where the students are given something to read and they read it silently in the class for a sustained period of time in preparation then to talk about it at a later time or another class. And, you know, I think that's what it was like in the past to read the news, that there wasn't something that was necessarily agitating about it. And I think what we have with watching things on television, multiple senses being engaged, and you not only have the way that they're talking about the news stories, but all the commercials and everything that are speckled in between these things that can even be objectionable in their own right. You know, we see things in commercials that would have made my grandparents shudder, you know, if they knew what was going on. Okay. So you get to get general gist, though, of where he's leading her. Anybody have any comments or thoughts about what he's saying? I think it's really challenging. I mentioned to you before, I think, Father Paisius, an elder from Mount Athos who died not too long ago and was canonized not too long ago in the Eastern Church. But in any case, he said for the young in our day, preserving and fostering purity of heart is going to be as challenging and difficult and require the courage that was needed for those who were the martyrs of old. So in our time, maintaining that purity of heart is going to require a kind of spiritual discipline, courage, engagement in the spiritual life that would be equal to the saints and martyrs of the early ages of the church, which in my mind is an extraordinary thing, because he's telling us that, you know, this battle is going to be a fierce one, and it's going, you know, the formation in the faith is going to be have to be far greater than what it is now, certainly. Natalia Wohar. Wohar.
Hi. I have a question about, so I like it when he says, when we stop feeding the passions, it exhausts them, mm-hmm. but also this constant warfare, like internally plus the active, that can exhaust us, that can exhaust me sometimes. And I think it goes back to what we've been talking about with perseverance and with like living this life habitually. But I was just wondering if you could speak into the moments where it's just so exhausting to have, like, not to feel that success right away and to have those passions just be like coming at me nonstop.
Right. Yeah. It's an excellent thought and question, because the spiritual life can feel exhausting at times, especially if we are struggling with passions that have become deeply rooted over time, or where there is the kind of eruption that he speaks of, where, you know, we are afflicted by a kind of wave of temptations that might come across us. And what we find in the fathers, I think, is this emphasis upon endurance. And what they're taking hold of there is taught to us in the scriptures. Make sure your endurance carries you all the way to the end. That there is a kind of perseverance in the spiritual life that is needed, because the relentlessness of the battle at times, that we know that we struggle against principalities and powers. And so it's not even the struggle against with our own thoughts and the things that arise from ourselves and or arise out of our own negligence. But we're engaged in this spiritual warfare with one who is relentless and, as it were, never sleeps. And so how does one not become discouraged in that? And part of it is through this perseverance. Part of it, I think, is through allowing ourselves to rest upon Christ himself, that we don't seek to engage in the spiritual battle simply by strength of will, but by grace. And so that we engage frequently in the sacraments. We receive Holy Communion often. We go to confession frequently. And then we engage in those practices that he'll be exposing her to and has already done so, such as spiritual reading, the divine office. We participate in the prayer of the church. You know, all the things that strengthen us in that battle and do help us endure and that spur us on, as it were, to victory. The lives of the saints. So we have these examples of those who are, you know, our generation looks to these fantasy heroes. And, you know, all these Marvel movies and things like that are very attractive. You know, those who, in this kind of heroic way, fight against evil. But, you know, within the life of faith, we look to the saints as those who encourage us in the spiritual battle, especially when things are going very difficult. This week, we celebrated the Feast of St. Bartholomew, and the story about him is shockingly painful to hear, you know, what he went through in terms of his evangelization efforts. If you remember, for those who were at Mass that day, I had mentioned it, that he had converted the king of Armenia, and the king's brother had become infuriated by it, and in his fury had Bartholomew flayed, so skinned alive. And I remember the first time I saw a statue of this, and it sort of confused me for a moment because it was a statue of St. Bartholomew, and it looked like he had a cloak flung over his shoulder, and he was really ripped. You know, you could see every muscle. And I thought, wow, that's sort of a striking statue of a saint. You know, this guy was buff, you know, in reality, what was flung over his shoulder was his skin. And what you could see were like all the sinews and the muscles, and because that's how he was martyred. And so he was presented in this way. And so, you know, when we hear these stories about them, we are encouraged by their courage and their fidelity to Christ. But also when we hear more about their life, we see what aided them in that, either the particular virtues or the spiritual exercises that they engaged in. The gospel for that day spoke of Nathaniel or Bartholomew having no guile. And I mentioned this in the homily that, you know, a person who does have guile has perfected the art of deception and speaks out of both sides of his mouth, as it were, and always is looking through something that is a kind of lens of how this would benefit me, how I could sort of manipulate and the circumstances that it serves me in some way. And so for Jesus to say of Nathanael, here is one with no guile, no duplicity, it means that Nathanael was sort of transparent and honest and sincere. And it gave him this ability, you know, because he was so transparent and lacked guile, that he could also see through to the truth very quickly. And so when he comes upon Jesus and Jesus says, I saw you under the fig tree, if you remember, Nathanael cries out, you are the Son of God. And it's sort of a striking thing, you know, simply because, I don't know about all of you, but that wouldn't, just because somebody said they saw me sitting under a fig tree, that wouldn't make me cry out that you are the Son of God or elicit that amount of faith. But his guilelessness allowed him to see through this deeper reality. The one that he, sitting under a fig tree, is usually a person tied to a person contemplating and reflecting on the scriptures. and certainly for the Jew, you know, that their hope would be for the coming of the Messiah. And so when encountering Jesus, he's able to see through this simple remark to see Jesus' true identity. But the reason I go sort of laboriously through this is that I think this quality, this particular virtue that he had, also allowed him to see through the intense suffering that he would go, that he would endure in order to bear witness to Christ in the gospel. That despite going through these tortures, that he could see through them to the promise of the resurrection. And so when we reflect upon the lives of the saints and these particular virtues, as well as their heroic deeds, it's what allows us then also to hold fast when we're engaged in this kind of spiritual warfare. And I also think that in the spiritual life, I was reading today, I don't know if it was from Theophan or if it was from Climacus, that, you know, that we, when we engage the saints, that, you know, we engage them directly and they hear us and that they intercede directly on our behalf in the spiritual warfare. And I think this is also something that helps us to endure on a day-to-day basis when we are really struggling along until we have tasted something of the sweetness of those virtues and the fruit, something of the fruit of that spiritual warfare for ourselves, the internal peace, the stillness, even the fruit, say, of purity of heart, of chastity, the capacity to love others with a greater freedom or to love God with a greater depth, that until we've tasted that and begin to long for it and desire it, the saints are often those who encourage us through their prayers, through the witness of their lives, or through their writings. And it's interesting, in the spiritual life, I think there are often those saints that we encounter that we develop a particular relationship with, who become our special patron, that there's something about them, the way that they live their life, the way that they write, that speaks to our heart in a particular way. And so they become, over the course of the years, our kind of spiritual guides. And I think we've often talked about the Eastern Rites, and I think we capture this in the West, certainly through our stained glass windows, our religious art statues, things such as that, but in the Eastern Rites, in particular, through their iconography, the iconostasis or the icons throughout the church, that there is this constant reminder of the saints, the lives that they lived, but also the glory that they exist in now. And so it's all these things put together, but I think it's most especially when we begin to taste something of the fruit of the spiritual life that allows us then to have that kind of endurance. And he told her early on, you know, when we embrace that constant remembrance of God that he describes really as the foothold for us in the spiritual battle, this constant turning of the mind and the heart toward God, that he says, you know, we won't perfect that practice probably for a long time, but it won't be long before one begins to experience and taste something of the fruit of that, that even if in a weak way, or if we lose hold of it on occasion and have to keep bringing ourselves back to it, it still begins to bear fruit for us. And we gradually begin to experience some of that internal peace or freedom from fear and anxiety. And so are able then to persevere through some of the difficult things of day-to-day life, as well as the challenge that the passions have for us. I don't know, do you have anything to follow up there or any? Did I answer your question?
Yes, you more than answered it. But it was, as you were talking, I realized like maybe if you're exhausted, then you're not doing it right. Like if you're doing all the things that you were just describing, then it would kind of prevent that burnout. So,
yeah, I don't think it's, you know, I think it is a spiritual warfare. And we should, you know, you ask any soldier, you know, they're running on fumes. And, you know, they've seen the worst things in the world and, you know, that they're, you know, are exhausted from being in the midst of battle, and yet they continue to move through because of the clarity of, that they have in their mind in terms of their identity and their purpose. And if you've ever talked to a Marine, you have a real sense of that, you know, how clear that is for them, that identity and what their purpose is. And so they often will face things that would make most of us, you know, run away with fear. And I think we have to see the spiritual life for what it is. And this is where I think the church's catechesis has really fallen apart. And not just in the last 50, 60 years, but I think long before that, in the sense of keeping this connection with the spiritual tradition as a whole. That we, you know, we are aware of all these different schools of spiritual thought. And most of the time people will pick and, you know, choose certain elements of it. But rarely do we have this kind of sustained description of the spiritual life that we're getting from, say, St. Theophan or what he gave to St. Anastasia. Like, it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I was exposed to something like this. And we, I think, really need in our formation of the youth to be putting before them the lives of the saints, but also the spiritual teachings in such a way that they could grasp about that this is a spiritual battle, and that what we expose ourselves to and is important, and that it is a real warfare, and that there is a particular enemy that we are struggling against. And I think a lot of that has been sort of popularized, you know, movies like The Exorcist or something along those lines, where this kind of evil personification of evil is presented in this extreme way in order to scare people out of their wits, you know, as entertainment. And I think as that has emerged, you know, these kind of thriller movies, you know, horror movies, you know, it does that. But I think what that's done to us is it's dulled our sensibilities, I think, in regards to the real spiritual battle that we fight. The idea of warfare is, you know, it has this connotation to it that a lot of people don't like to think about the spiritual life in that way. Because I think often people will gravitate to the spiritual life as a means of finding psychological or emotional respite. And so we've often hear the terms, you know, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Because immediately when you say that, you pull out the whole moral aspect of the spiritual life. But I think you also remove everything that we're talking about, in the sense of guarding the senses and being aware of one's thoughts and feelings and desires. You pull out the whole aspect of spiritual warfare. And so the spiritual life becomes a way of comforting oneself, you know, like a binky for adults, rather than, you know, engaged in something that we see the saints engaged in. Okay. Sawyer and Carl.
So I just had one thought. Also, I think when I'm really struggling and kind of falling down a lot, I feel like it's an opportunity for deepening humility, and that kind of recognition of my own insufficiency and kind of, I almost feel like God allows that at times, if, you know, if I'm starting to get a little too reliant on myself, that kind of brings me back to a place of, okay, this is God, and I got to hand it over. And it's a kind of a sense of abandonment. Right. And the other aspect, I think the love for God as motivation, that keeping that kind of
front and center, as that all of this is out of love for God, and that desire kind of flows out of that. And if you can kind of a focus on deepening that love, then I think sometimes the motivation to keep fighting and keep be able to do that can flow out of that too.
Right. Yeah, two superb points. You know, humility, and then love of God. That, you know, even in the spiritual life, and even in the pursuit of virtue, sometimes the ego will take center stage. That even our pursuit of the religious life can revolve around ourselves and building up a certain kind of religious identity. And so often we will engage in the spiritual life, trying to struggle. Maybe by the use of our own will or intellect, you know, as if we could live the heroic life of the gospel simply by, you know, doing everything right, or simply by natural virtue, you know, fostering certain behaviors, but not necessarily aided by the grace of God. And so often we are allowed to experience something of our poverty when that becomes true, when we are neglectful, for example, of our prayer life, and we begin again to sort of rest upon our own strength, we are often allowed to experience the consequence of that, of a fall. Or if we expose ourselves to things thinking, oh, I have the strength to do this, that I won't be impacted by it. And then the next thing you know, we're drawn down this particular path and we're humbled by it in a very deep way. And often it can be over the course of years, where until we let go of that illusion that we are dependent upon the grace of God, that He is the beginning and end of all that we do. And so when we engage in the spiritual life, you know, and this is what Theophan tries to teach Anastasia from the beginning, everything is to be subordinated to God. You know, how we look at our lives has to be through this lens, the lens of this relationship, because outside of that, we aren't going to be able to live it. And so we're not simply pursuing natural virtue or to be good people. We're seeking to be holy as our Heavenly Father is holy, to be perfect as He is perfect, to love the unlovely, to forgive the unforgivable, love our enemies, pray for those who persecute us, do not resist one who is evil. You know, who of us has the capacity by mere strength of will or simply by our own desire to do that, unaided by the grace of God, or let alone to endure what Bartholomew endured? And your second point, you know, having at the center of this our relationship with God, you know, this we do it for Him, that it's out of love, that our belief, even in the truths of what we're reading here in Theophan, they're all inextricably tied to this living and vital relationship with Christ. And so simply reading and having in our mind the truths of the spiritual life, of these truths of the spiritual life, is going to bear absolutely no fruit for us outside of that living relationship with Christ that we experience through the sacraments and through the life of prayer. And so only in union with Him, this union and communion of love, are we able to live it. And so sometimes Christ becomes, you know, an abstracted concept for us rather than a living reality. So rather than being the heavenly bridegroom, you know, He becomes, you know, mere teacher, you know, or something along those lines. Any follow-up, or was that? So I think the points are perfect, you know, humility and love of Christ. Eric.
So I was just wondering, with the active warfare stuff, so it seems like a lot of the scenarios that he's talking about are either really require a pretty dramatic change of course of life, like changing an occupation to do menial labor, or shutting yourself up at home. Or conversely, they're kind of like decisions to not engage in entertainment. You know, that's untoward or good, you know, not the best choice. So it's kind of like, I guess what I'm wondering is, how do you engage in active warfare when you want to retain some kind of standard of living, in the sense of, you know, I mean, you have your job and you are doing jobs like it, and you're probably going to continue doing jobs like it. And if you go away from those kinds of jobs by becoming a day laborer or something like that, that could damage you in terms of your socioeconomic status for a while because of how things work now, and, you know, things like that. So basically what I'm saying is, how can you engage in active warfare when a lot of what happens to you cannot change and is really just completely out of your control, except for little things like choosing not to see movies or things like that?
Right.
What choices do you make, I guess? What can you make?
Okay. Well, the first thought that came to mind, of a couple thoughts. The first thought that came to mind, that with this pandemic, even, it sort of jarred people and their sensibilities and made them think about their life. You know, when faced with the reality of death, the possibility of death, and also with the shutdown of society as a whole, you know, this lockdown, it made them reevaluate, a lot of people reevaluate their lives as a whole and how they were living and the jobs they had. And so not everybody, but for many people, it was a kind of turning point for them, saying it gave them a little bit of space to think about, you know, how involved am I in my family's life? And where do I work and where do I spend my time? And so a lot of people got used to working at home, and they began to see, gee, working at home gives me this opportunity to be with my spouse and my children like not never before. And so maybe I'm going to take a job where I can do that. Or maybe I'm going to press with my present employment if it's a possibility to do that. Or a lot of people even moved to a completely different city. You know, I think when they became locked down and things slowed down enough where they weren't able even to go to work, it even made them reevaluate, where am I living my life? And what is the pace of my life? You know, is it a frenetic pace? And is the environment that I'm living in conducive to the kind of life that I would want for myself or my family? So even these, you know, worldly events that we've experienced recently sort of awaken people to the weight of the things that they have in their life, the meaning and significance of them, and give them the will to change them. And the second thought I had was Christ's initial call of the apostles, that when encountered with love incarnate, that the word, you know, follow me was enough to lead them to drop everything, their nets, their boat, with some of them, their father, Matthew, to exit the tax office, you know, to leave behind, you know, something that was lucrative for him, because they had encountered he who is love. And so similarly, I think, you know, often when someone falls in love, you know, they are willing to do radical things. Sometimes their family think it's even stupid that they would be willing to do this for someone that they want to marry or that they've fallen in love with, that they will make these radical changes in their life or they'll move here or there, things such as that. But for Christ, you know, I think it's this recognition of who he is, the depth of his love for us, what he's made possible for us. This becomes the frame in which we view our life and how we are living our life. And I've seen something similar in and through the pandemic as well, that it did slow things down a lot for people on a spiritual level. You know, that they didn't have the things to hold on to that gave them identity in other ways, like with their work or entertainment, you know, all that shut down. But it also, you know, especially when the churches were locked up and the availability of the sacraments was very limited or non-existent, I think it made a lot of people think about their practice of the faith, what those things really mean for them as Catholic Christians. And I've told you the story before when the bishop finally allowed us to start having confessions, and we even had to do them outdoors, that we had big lines of people, and it was March, and it was raining, and it was even snowing at that point, and people would be kneeling in puddles to go to confession, thanking us for hearing them, you know, for being present to do it. And so this whole experience opened their eyes to the importance and the value of what perhaps they had taken for granted. And also, I think that by extension then, made them look more deeply at their relationship with Christ and their life of prayer as a whole. And we've seen this take place at different times in history too. Like right after the Second World War, there was this huge influx of, say, men. I've read this in particular about the Trappist communities. There was this huge influx of men with vocations that they had gone through, and they had seen the horrors of war, and it had heightened their sensibilities in the sense of the meaning of life, but also the vulnerability of life, that those communities burst at the seams. You know, Thomas Merton writes about, you know, when he became a Trappist, they were living in these big halls. You know, think about it. There were like bunk beds for monks all living in this huge room, like barracks. I mean, that's how many there were of them at that time. But it was because their eyes were open to some significant truth about their life, their relationship with God, their mortality. And I think when something like that happens in our life in terms of our relationship with Christ, when our eyes are opened to who he is, what he means for us, the identity that he gives to our lives, then like the first apostles, we are able to drop the things, sometimes the things that have existed for decades in our life that seem so important for us in our identity, we're able to drop them for that which is greater, and that which has greater meaning for us. And so this can't be seen simply as a kind of ordering of our life or a simplifying of our life. Again, outside of the context of that vital and living relationship with Christ. Like there are a lot of people now that have gravitated to a minimalist kind of state of life, that they found a certain value in simplifying their life from material goods that gives them a kind of freedom. Have you ever seen those like small houses, those teeny houses online? They're sort of laughable. I mean, I couldn't move around in them, but there are people who do this. They'll radically simplify their lives and live in these teeny buildings with, you know, one change or two changes of clothes, a few books and stuff like that. And just in order to have this kind of personal and emotional freedom. And when we think of our relationship with Christ and that all that is promised to us in and through it, and not in some distant future, and not simply a kind of simplicity of life or worldly peace or emotional peace, but a peace of the kingdom, and an experience of eternal life and love, and our ability to taste and experience that now and then through this relationship. What does that do in terms of allowing us to see, you know, when we begin to see our lives through that lens, what does that then allow us to do in regards to the choices that we make about how we live our life on a day-to-day basis and how we simplify it? And you're right, there are certain circumstances that we might not be able to alter, you know, responsibilities that we have, family, children, a job, you know, certain things such as that. But how we enter into those, engage in those realities might radically change as well. You know, either in terms of our capacity to endure certain things that are very difficult to bear, or how we engage people in relationships, in marriage, our family, extended family, friendships. You know, all those things begin to change and take on a different value in and through that relationship with Christ, and are going to change radically. So just as radical, you know, when those apostles dropped their nets, left their boat, everything behind, something similar can take place in our life, if only in the way that we live it. It might not mean certainly that we leave our family behind, but how we choose to engage them and what we place at the center of our life, you know, that if all of a sudden the whole family's life shifts and Christ becomes the very center of their life together, then the way that they interact and the way that they live their life and the things that they do are going to alter over the course of time too. And that doesn't mean that their life is going to be void of joy or entertainment. In fact, one would say that it would heighten it. Now, I've always thought that that statement, love is blind, is actually it's a lie. It's an error. Love sees things with a perfect clarity and allows us to see through to that which has deeper meaning and value. So love, true love, doesn't, for example, with a spouse, doesn't make them blind to their spouse's weakness or the irritating things that they do, you know, things such as that. But it allows them to see their true dignity as human beings. And sometimes it's those little picadillos, those weird things that their spouses do that eventually bind them in a deeper way together. It's what makes the relationship sort of unique. But it's that love that allows them to see the fullness of the truth. And those who come to resent and despise that on some level are the blind ones, that they can't see past those weaknesses and those flaws. And so the other becomes diminished in their eyes and in their heart. And so love sees with a perfect clarity. Now, people often think of Mary as suffering less than others. Oh, she was perfect one. She becomes like this ivory little statue kind of thing. And in reality, it's, you know, because of her freedom from sin that somehow it preserved her from the experiencing some of the things that we know in our weaknesses and our great sin. The opposite is true. You know, it gave her this deeper capacity to love and to enter into the suffering of others, an empathy and a sympathy that was so radical that, like her son, she could see the sufferings of others, but with her son, experience that sword will pierce through your heart as well, mystically, that in her love, she participates in the suffering of her son. So Christ's suffering on the cross wasn't simply the torture of a man for 3 hours. You know, what he experienced in perfect love was all the sin of the world and the consequence of that sin of the world from the beginning of time through the end of time and in every person's life, and participates intimately in all the sufferings that we endure in order that we might not experience those things in isolation. All of that he has taken upon himself in the perfection of love. Now, I've gone a little far field here, but I think back to your point is that that love of Christ brings a kind of radical clarity to our vision, the choices, the decisions that we make in our life, and how we live our life, and how we engage others. So we don't want to turn the ascetical life into something that, again, is abstracted from that relationship, because then it just becomes self-discipline, you know, that we're doing in order to bring a kind of order to our life. Well, that has a certain value, but it doesn't take us very far. But when it's done in order to help us to love Christ more fully, when it removes those impediments to our loving Christ, is when we really see the fruit of them. But not before. They have little or no value outside of that relationship. It's funny, the gospel that we read at the beginning of Lent basically tells us that. You know, if you fast in order that you might be seen by others as fasting, you know, you look miserable, sad, and your hair is all greasy and matted to your head. Well, you know, people are going to see you as an ascetic, and you'll probably have bad breath and a headache, but that's your reward in full, your payment in full, Jesus says in the gospel. Or if you give money, people are going to see you as a philanthropist, generous, but that's all you get. That's your reward in full, your payment in full. And so outside of the context of that relationship, all of those things will have no meaning for us. So again, it sort of brings us back to source points, you know, humility, love, you know, we take these things up. These are the primary virtues. And when we are living them, then we gain this kind of clarity about how we are to order our lives toward Christ, how we simplify them in order to more to protect ourselves from the things that would prevent us from loving him or loving others. You know, having a home or owning a home isn't contrary to the gospel. You know, that's where you would raise your family. You know, it's the domestic church. You know, it can be a place of great love. But, you know, what place that has in our minds and our hearts shifts. Any other final thoughts or comments? That seemed like a lot tonight. I didn't even drink any coffee after dinner. But I'm glad we do take these little digressions, because I wouldn't want us to fall into that trap. You know, when we're looking at the ascetical life outside of that relationship with Christ. Because then I think, you know, going back to what Natalia was talking about, it can crush us. You know, it can make us feel like we're being smothered by it. Because when we have that experience of our own poverty outside of that relationship with Christ, we're going to sink into depression. You know, the moment that we become more attentive to those things and we're laboring with them and fighting them and, you know, I think the only path that that's going to take us is to lead us in a spiral downwards, you know, but in that relationship with Christ, then we know that we're not alone on the battlefield, that we know that he does not look at that with a kind of harshness, that the mere movement of the mind and the heart to him brings a flood of mercy, of grace, you know, and so we, far from feeling crushed by it, you know, that when we step back into that relationship, we enter into the battle with even greater zeal. Okay. Wow, that was a lot. I love Theophan. Who would have thought a guy named Theophan the Recluse would be so extraordinary? Okay. So when we close there, as always, with Our Father, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
With your spirit.
Almighty God, bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.